Today's episode is about pandemics and viruses with the coronavirus coming out in China. We thought we'd just do like an impromptu informational. And Scott and called and invited one of our guests on today.
Yeah, reached out to a friend of mine, and she and I actually have a mutual friend, Dr. Jeanette Luch.
Yay, applause.
I was going to say. So Jeanette is actually a member of the U.S. AO staff and has been for a number of years now, since 2007. She's actually a professor of biology and actually teaches virology, virology lab, basic microbiology, cell biology, and just a wealth of knowledge when it comes to immunology and all things in the life sciences. Thanks for joining us today, Jeanette. Do you like to introduce yourself and a little bit more information?
Yeah, so I've been studying virology since I started working on my PhD in 1990. So my specialty is actually herpes viruses. My PhD work was with an animal herpes virus, and my postdoctoral experience was working with HSV-1 that causes eye infections, and if there's a way that we could treat them better to prevent the nerve cells behind the eye from getting infected. And so I've been working with viruses for quite some time and really enjoy all things that require very expensive microscopes and technology to use. So I'm not really the kind of biologist that can identify trees and plants and stuff. More so all tiny things that require microscopes and specialized equipment.
Well, that's exciting. So my mother worked in communicable disease division of the State Health Department in Oklahoma for a very, very long time. She worked in immunizations, and I was raised being curious and excited about all things germ-wise. I basically was raised as a giant germaphobe, but it wasn't in the sense that people were like, oh, that's dirty, don't touch it. My mom was like, hey, if you know, here's a study on how things spread and why. And as a child, I was always very, very interested in that. To this day, I suppose, and I'm sure the boys can attest, there are times too when I'm like, nope, don't drink that. Don't touch that. No, don't do that. But it's a really interesting science, and it affects us way more, I think, than people actually realize. I also come from a family of people who have immunosuppression problems, and they are very susceptible to, you know, strains of things, and that's always been something that's come across. But the science is a lot of math, and I don't know if I could handle it. So I'm very excited about all your publications. I did see the collagen shields for ocular drug delivery. Was that part of your study?
Yeah, that was part of the stuff that I did as a postdoc at LSU in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. I worked at the LSU Eye Center there, and we were just trying to find ways to apply medication to the cornea that allowed for, you know, treatment for bacterial or fungal or viral infections. And so we experimented a lot with some of those types of techniques, as well as, you know, manipulating viruses to make mutations in various different parts to see if we could figure out why some people, specifically with herpes virus, why some people are constantly having what we call reoccurrences, where the virus comes back, and why some people don't have a lot of reoccurrences. And so I like to talk to my students about the fact that the only time I ever had a herpes infection on my lip was the weekend at my brother's wedding and during our lectures in microbiology, where we learned about herpes viruses, and the teacher continued to point that out at, you know, numerous times. But so it's just interesting on how viruses interact, and it's so complicated because viruses and the host that they infect, you know, it's everybody is different, and so everybody responds differently to viruses and what they can do to you. And so I think it makes for interesting science, as well as the possibility of some very novel work.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and I think that's kind of a great lead-in to one of the topical questions that we had on that. And I just from the sheer fact that from what you generally see in the news and the media and things like that, when it comes to viruses, I know there's several different types, but usually when you see it kind of used out in the real world, so to speak, they don't make a distinction in what is what. So like right now, you know, with the current coronavirus, we don't kind of denote the difference between that and some of the others.
Well, and also, and just briefly before we get started on this, one of the things I did before we came was look it up, and I think we need to specify, just for our own safety, to state we're talking about it's the novel coronavirus, because I think the distinction is, one is, has not been seen before, like it's a newer thing that's a new mutation, I believe, and probably she can talk more about this, but I think the coronavirus is a collection of viruses, correct?
Right. So viruses are kind of classified in a lot of different ways. The big category, the way I teach this kind of a topic with my students, and I talk to about it with people who are not, you know, virologists, is viruses have the ability to be categorized either by their genetic material, which most people go, oh, it must be DNA because everything has DNA. Well, viruses are the little the weirdos kind of the world. Is we have some viruses that are RNA as opposed to DNA. And so what that means then is they are much more susceptible to problems in their replication of their genetic material than, let's say, a DNA virus or a cell that has DNA, like your cells or bacterial cells or, you know, insert your favorite animal / plant cell. And so the thing about the coronavirus is it's an RNA virus, so it can change pretty quickly in a population because of the fact that we, as the host cell, the cell that actually does the replicating for the virus, makes more mistakes than, let's say, if we were going to be replicating a DNA virus. So if you think about them based on their genetic makeup, all viruses are living inside of a host cell and then takes advantage of that host cell's ability to help them replicate, to make more virus, to make the host sicker, as well as to pass on to other potential hosts out there in the population. And so for coronaviruses, it's a large family of virus that infect very many different types of animals. There's technically, if you take this new one out, about 5 viruses in the coronavirus family that can infect humans. Most of them will infect other animals, and they basically stay in those other animals. But occasionally, something happens to that particular virus where it's allowed to what we call jump from, let's say, a cat or a dog or a pig into a human. Most of the time, if we get exposed to a cat coronavirus, our body says, I don't know what you're doing. I don't even recognize you, so we don't get sick. What's happened with this new one is it seems that I think they're thinking right now that it came from an animal, like from an animal market. They're not 100% sure, because about half of the people in China who are sick had visited an animal market, like for food sources, and the other half has not. So we're not really sure where it's coming from at this particular point, but they do have the ability to jump occasionally, not often, but when they do, that's when it becomes a little bit more problematic, because now we have an animal virus that now recognizes humans, which means that humans can spread it to other humans, which is where we're at in this particular thing, is they're trying to contain it as best as they can so that it doesn't jump from one person to the next person. And then setting this up for a very large pandemic type of an infection, as opposed to right now, it's still kind of considered an epidemic in the China area. Because so far right now, everybody else is, because people have been in Wuhan, China, and have gone back home. So it's not a true pandemic just yet.
Right. Well, and so one thing I think, what you're talking about, and I've just had my own experience with viruses recently, so having a good thought process isn't exactly great right now. what you were talking about with, like, zoonotic or whatever sort of mutations, like, a good example of that was the 2009 swine flu, because it was H1N1, but it was able to, you know, cross species barriers, and that's how it was able to affect so many people.
Are we seeing that more and more, kind of as time goes? I know, you know, humans are very unique in that we, you know, we are really, in one particular respect, probably one of the only animals that keep other animals in close proximity. So the chances of this sort of interspecies jumping is greatly increased. But are we seeing it more and more with the, you know, population density increase, you know, the ever-growing kind of, you know, animal and poultry industry?
I don't know if we're actually seeing more. The issue with the influenza virus that makes it a much more likely candidate to go from one species to another species is because it is by far and away one of the very few viruses that actually have multiple gene segments. Most of the viruses that we talk about have a single, essentially a single chromosome. But what influenza does is it has 8 different chromosomes, essentially. I mean, if you want to think about small fragments of RNA being a chromosome. And what happens is, if you get infected by 2 different organisms at the same time, they can mix and match themselves and then move on to the next host, which is why the flu season, you know, is so heavily contingent on what happened, you know, like in the southern hemisphere in the winter before, for them to select what we're going to use for this particular flu season. And sometimes they get it right, and sometimes the virus just says, you know what, I'm an RNA virus, I can do what I want, and I'm going to change enough that your vaccine isn't going to work, or, you know, you're going to completely miss, you know, the strain of the virus that we're trying to get at this particular point. But because we do live in close proximity, especially to avian species and like the swine species, and again, farming and that type of thing, we're more exposed to the possibility of being infected or being at least exposed to a swine influenza virus when we're also introduced to a human influenza virus, and then they have a tendency to mix and match and then can spread and become a new strain of the virus, which is why we always have to be constantly re-immunized, because every year that combination has the potential to be very different.
I've also heard people say that because of that specific aspect of it, including, I've heard a few doctors say this, but they always equate it back to like the outbreak movies where you get the conspiracy people who are like, we're breeding the super flu, which to an extent is, you know, scientifically true. We are breeding the super flu because it continues to adapt. But
yeah, I think that's what we really are kind of concerned with. I think while this coronavirus infection that's happening now is important, I think that potential for the right virus to come along that can easily spread between humans is, I mean, it's going to be out there. I mean, it happened in 1918 with the influenza epidemic then, that, you know, because we were in the middle of World War I, and it initially kind of started with soldiers in Kansas and has kind of then moved across the United States. And then when we sent those guys, that we weren't even sure what they had because we didn't really understand viruses at all in 1918. In fact, I'm still not 100% sure that they have really isolated where that source comes from. I mean, for a long time, they thought it was some kind of a weird bacteria that caused the infection, because it wasn't until the 1950s when we could actually see a virus and study viruses and the electron microscope. So there's some evidence that, you know, that spread kind of happened because people were going off to war and that sort of thing. And I find that whole epidemic to be truly fascinating, to listen to people talk about what they think may have happened or what they think could potentially happen if we would get another outbreak. That's why the influenza in the swine flu in 2009 was so scary, is because it mimicked so much the flu of 1918 when it wasn't the young people and the old people who were getting sick. It was the, you know, 20 to 30-year-old people who were getting sick and dying, which is not normal for influenza. Nor is influenza normally something that happens in the spring or summer, which is, again, what happened with the influenza in 1918, was it was a summer flu as opposed to a winter flu, which is what we're used to. So those are the kinds of things I think, like, the CDC and the World Health Organization are concerned about, is when we start to see this pattern that reflects the big bad pandemics of the past. And so I think, you know, we just need to kind of keep an eye on it and try to contain when we have an outbreak, like they're trying to contain the coronavirus now.
When one on the same vein as the 1918 H1N1, you know, subtype A, the reason bringing it back to one of our questions that we have for you, the reason that it's called the Spanish flu, from what I could see, was because at the time, again, wartime situation going on, the records weren't great, but the military had good records. And also, they didn't want to, like, decrease people's morale. So it was easier to report on, you know, neutral Spain or whatever it was. And it stuck with people. That's why they called it the Spanish flu, even though it was way more prolific in other parts of the world than that. And I think one thing that we were wondering is, you know, with the strain in the news the way it is, I'm able, as a discerning individual, to, of course, it's obviously Google foo, and I'm not a scientist, but I can at least take a couple of minutes to say, okay, the news is making this sound like the next zombie apocalypse is imminent, and we're all going to need to be sequestered into our bunkers or something. But I think it has a lot to do with the way things are reported and sensationalism, and things like, for instance, using terms like epidemic or pandemic. How do you feel that, you know, this is really different or similar from past epidemics as far as the way that it's being reported? Because I honestly think a lot of people, I've had people ask me, like, at my jobs, because they know how much I'm into weird, gross germ science, you know, what do you think about this? And it's this whole big thing. And I'm like, well, you're talking about a possibly new strain of something that's possibly airborne in a very high dense population area. It sounds pretty normal. It sounds like nature, but everyone I know at certain jobs, they're like, oh no, we're gonna, you know. I happen to have I got the flu last week, and they asked me all kinds of questions about had I been to China and things, and I get that. I get why they did that, but it also seemed a little silly at the time. I was like, well, now I haven't randomly been to the one province that might be affected very effectively right now. But how do you feel about that? I mean, the fact that the Spanish flu is called that is because of how it was reported. And how do you feel about it now?
I think that, I think right for us here in the United States, or even, you know, outside of that particular area of China, I think our risk is going to be low. I mean, in terms of it turning into this worldwide pandemic, because in order for it to be a pandemic, we have to start seeing people get it who haven't been to the epicenter, which right now is in Wuhan City. And so the people in the United States who have it are people who have been there and have come back, or have been associated with people who have been there. We have not yet, at least in my understanding, we have not seen, other than maybe with healthcare workers early on in the infection, being exposed to people before they realized what it was. I think people here in the United States, and the fact that we are kind of sequestering them in four or five cities that have the capability to take care of those people, I think we're going to see that those numbers are going to start to drop, I hope. I think we're trying to do a good enough job with the World Health Organization and the CDC, you know, preparing people and asking people who now come in with these same symptoms, because that's the really hard problem, is right now in this particular time frame, of this, you know, late winter kind of thing, what we're looking at is we could be talking about the rhinovirus, which causes the common cold, or the influenza virus, or now the coronavirus, and they all kind of look and act the same. They make you feel sick, they make you have a fever, they make your nose run, they make you cough. You know, so I think the what seems maybe to people who go in thinking they have the flu or maybe, you know, are developing a head cold or whatever, that they're being a little crazy asking, have I been to China? I think it's good because I think it kind of is going to prevent that from happening. And I think by giving them a name now, like, you know, they're not calling it the Wuhan City virus, which is the way we used to do things.
Yeah.
And that's kind of, I think, this other thing about the Spanish flu is we kind of name new viruses based on where they develop. Mm-hmm. And so I think by taking this idea of making it the coronavirus of 2019 and calling it COVID-19 instead of the Wuhan virus, I think maybe we can correct some of this strangeness of, like, you know, classifying it based on where it came from. Because the Spanish flu, the Spain was basically less impacted than many other countries, but
right.
I think it just, and it may be too that that's kind of where it started to show up. You know, I mean, when we had people who, like, landed there, you know, they passed it along, and so that may have been part of that whole idea of making it the Spanish flu. But I find it to be very interesting that we're trying really hard now to give them names that aren't equated with various different places, because I think over time people are going to not be afraid of going to this particular part of China, whereas if we kept calling it that particular Wuhan City virus or what have you, that that may have a bigger impact, you know, on some of these communities that are, you know, dependent on people coming to their particular area.
Absolutely. So, historically, with kind of the number of viruses that have really kind of came out over the years, I mean, we see very much to your point there. I mean, you know, in the 60s, there was the Hong Kong flu epidemic, and then late 50s, there was the quote-unquote the Asian flu, and then going all the way back, I mean, to really the late 1800s, where they referred to it as, there was an outbreak, the Asiatic or Russian flu.
Right.
I never thought about it in that aspect of trying to be more truthful.
More now.
Yeah.
Pardon?
Oh, I was saying I never really thought about it in that aspect that we were improving. I guess I'm kind of a pessimist in that way that we may be improving because we're trying to be more like, no, this is the scientific name for it, and be more discerning. But I think it's how we consume information. You know, there's a lot of media out there and people. Just the fact that a human being would come up to me and be like, oh, have you heard about this coronavirus? Mm-hmm. You know, I think it just puts me in a perspective of, well, people still out there are unable to, at face value, discern information, take it in, and say, I need to go, look at this for myself and see how it is, instead of being... I've had people at my job who were highly concerned that they needed to vacate to their bunker because the next outbreak situation was happening. And when I say that, I'm talking about the movie, the overdramaticized movie.
Well, to be honest, it makes me so frustrated when I see those movies where they're talking about this kind of stuff and they see scientists practicing on themselves and, oh, what was that silly movie with the monkey that was going to save everybody? I'm like,
yeah, outbreak.
That little 8-pound monkey can't possibly save a community of 600 when they need like 2 or 3, you know, cups of, you know, serum. And I'm just like, oh my gosh. And I, you know, so it's that perpetuation of the crazy, you know, virus that's going to turn you into the zombie, or the virus that's going to wipe out everybody on the face of the earth. I mean, why that potential, I think, is out there, it's highly unlikely because we are so proactive now in terms of, you know, sequestering people and monitoring people, and even the people who aren't testing positive that have been exposed, you know, they are constantly watching them. I saw last night on the news that there's a woman, I believe, in Oklahoma City who's been over in that part, and, you know, she wears a mask when she goes outside of her house, and when she was being interviewed, you could tell that they were standing very far away, but she's had no signs or no symptoms. but they're kind of keeping her under quarantine to make sure that, you know, that it doesn't turn into something. Because the thing about this is it seems for various different people that the incubation time is very different, anywhere from 48 hours from exposure all the way up to 14 days or longer. Yeah. And I think we just have to be aware and conscious of the fact that you're sick, regardless of it being, you know, COVID-19 or some other infectious agent. You need to stay home with your kids. You need to, you know, take care not to spread it, because that's the big thing, and why the next pandemic is just right around the corner is, oh, I don't have to pay attention to that. Everybody else should stay home when they're sick, but I'm way too important. I must go to work when I'm sick. And you're just like going, no, just keep your little sick body home.
Right.
So that we don't have this massive epidemic, either of influenza A or B, which, you know, now we have treatments for that. So, you know, provided you get to your doctor soon enough, you know, in that first 48-hour window to be treated. But the best thing for any of those, even if it's just the common cold, is just to stay home and not pass it on to anybody else, because that's where that cycle of, you know, spread is coming from, is people who think they're way too important to take a sick day.
Yeah, I'm excited about that mentality, because I was able to tell, I deteriorated very quickly when I had the flu, and I just put a mask on and, you know, went to the doctor because I knew that it would be helpful. But I was also raised by an immunologist, and so when it comes to like the spread of things, I still to this day have problems like going into bars or restaurants and I see complete strangers like, sure, I'd love to try your vape or something, and I'm like, no. Touching ATMs is a panic attack basically every time. So
We've got to a point where we just have to be more conscious of that, especially during, you know, a particular outbreak like this. The best way to keep it from spreading is to not share things and not, you know, hang out with other sick people. You know, just kind of take a step back and, you know, make sure that, you know, you're taking good care of you so that we just don't have a whole bunch of really sick people.
Keep your germs and your viruses to yourself, people.
Absolutely. I think that's probably some of the best advice that I think any of us can get and give on this. So I think that kind of wraps up our episode today of Unexplained Oklahoma. Really, really, it was a pleasure, Dr. Lush, to have you on today. So informative, and really appreciate you taking the time out of your day to spend with us on this.
Yay.
Not a problem, anytime.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you guys so much. Susie?
Thank you for having me.
Oh, no, thank you.
Yep, I'm excited. If you have any questions for the doctor or for us, find us on the social media things. She has an incredible amount of publications and accolades if you, too, are wishing to dive deeper into the world of the virus and various other science things. Add us on Facebook, where you don't have to share your germs with us over the internet.
All right, Jonathan, wrap, take us out.
Well, thank you, everybody, for joining us. Stay tuned for the next episode. We'll announce that on Facebook. If you go to Anchor FM, you'll be able to help us out and support us and listen and share, mostly. Just share the episode.
Share your episode, not your germs.
Not your germs. Put it in a Ziploc bag and give it to your friend. Thank you, everyone. This is John.
I'm Susie.
And Scott.
And we'll see you next week.